about Melania Trump. By the way, he's a monster. I would never do anything like that, especially in this book three chapters ago. Sean Hannity took to Twitter calling Jimmy Harvey Weinstein Jr., among other insults. Jimmy shot back. It escalated, and Jimmy eventually wrote, "When your clown makeup rubs off on Trump's ass, does it make his butt look like a creamsicle?" before stepping away and moving on with his life. I have a simple policy. If the combined age of the two people feuding is over 100, they should move on. People try to incite these wars, like when two kids are arguing on the bus or the playground and everyone stands around them chanting, "Fight, fight, fight." At some point, I made a negative comment on my podcast regarding David Letterman, along the lines of not wanting to work for him. I know some people have worked for him, and the general impression I got was that he was difficult to say the least, a dick to say the most. Well, some pussy had to tweet Jimmy and say, "Did you hear what Adam had to say about your idol?" I'm sure Jimmy hadn't, and would have lived his life just fine without that information. More important, he's too fucking busy to listen to the podcast and get the context, so he's forced to assume I was saying shit about the man he regards as his mentor. This is the chick gossip queen gene run amok. A decade ago, when I wrote in 50 years we'll all be chicks, this behavior was reserved mostly for women and some dudes I'd never want to hang out with. But social media has weaponized the tattletale. "I just thought you should know, assholes," I complained about at the time. These guys gain nothing from this behavior. It's not like Twitter is a program where you get $1.95 every time you rat out a celebrity for talking shit. I found that the best move when someone is critical of me on Twitter is to kill them with kindness. I'm not contradicting my earlier declaration about not apologizing, but I am willing to own my mistakes or acknowledge a genuine grievance. No one likes it when they read a tweet that takes them to task, but you shouldn't reflexively tweet back, "Eat a dick." Take it in for a second and see if the person has a point. Find out what they disagree with, be a man, own it, and move on if it's true. Here's a good personal example. You might know the name Terri Schiavo, but here's a quick recap in case you don't. She was at the center of a big right-to-die case in Florida in the 1990s. In 1990, she suffered a heart attack and was resuscitated, but had severe brain damage. She was only 26 years old, which is insane statistically. This left her in a vegetative state. A legal feud between her husband and parents ensued, with him arguing that she would not have wanted to live that way and them fighting to keep her on the feeding tube, which was removed and reinserted several times based on the latest court ruling in the case. Jeb Bush, governor of Florida at the time, passed Terri's law to protect her and keep her on the feeding tube. It became a national issue, with civil libertarians and the religious right taking their respective sides. In March 2005, the tube was finally removed, and Terri died shortly after. For the record, as an atheist, I think it's selfish to keep people in that state on life support. I blame Hollywood for making too many awakenings-type movies with guys coming out of comas. It would be funny, though, to see someone wake up in 2020 from a coma that started in 2000. The World Trade Center was taken out in a terrorist attack. We're in two wars. Every kid has their own TV station on a website called YouTube. We all take pictures of every meal we eat. Prince and Michael Jackson are dead. Bill Cosby is in prison for rape. And Donald Trump is president. The guy would pull his own plug. As far as Terri Schiavo is concerned, and President me, I wrote, before I move on from vegetables to other areas covered by the USDA, I ought to name the Secretary of Agriculture. I'm going with Terri Schiavo. Not just because she was the world's most famous vegetable, but because she's no longer with us and I'm committed to reducing the size of government. In 2019, I received a tweet from her brother, Bobby Schindler, which reads, "It recently came to my attention that you wrote about my deceased sister, Terri Schiavo, in your book, President Me. Perhaps the next time you decide to target an innocent disabled woman With your crude humor, you will spell her name correctly. First off, the typo is something my co-writer, editor, copy editor, and proofreader should have caught. But it was my joke, and I owned it. I replied simply, "Sorry if I cause you any pain." Actually, looking back on the Twitter timeline, I see that I wrote, "Sorry if A caused you any pain." As I mentioned, I'm not great at working the Twitter machine. Point is that he was taken aback by my sincere apology. He replied, "That wasn't the response I was expecting, so thank you. I appreciate it." Twitter is not as uncivilized as we make it out to be. You would think that 50% of the time the person who critiqued you would come back with "fuck you" anyway. More often than not, however, they accept it, which reminds me of another story about a guy named Carter Lay. If the last name sounds familiar, it's because he's the heir to the $13 billion Frito-Lay empire. I met him doing the Long Beach Celebrity Grand Prix in 2014. Not only was he rich, but he had beaten leukemia and started a charity around it. On the day of the race, we were hanging out, and I was noticing his custom helmet and expensive racing shoes. When you do these celebrity pro-am races, everyone is issued standard shoes by a company called Simpson that are worth about $34. But if your family basically invented stoner chow, you can afford $300 custom kicks. He had Pumas with a titanium insert, and when I asked him why they laced up on the side, he told me that the laces on top could cut off the circulation in your foot. High-tech stuff. There was more technology in this guy's shoes than there was in the Corolla household my entire childhood. Unfortunately, he was one of the slower guys, and I lapped him 5 minutes into the race. On my All Things Automotive podcast, CarCast, I proceeded to make fun of him. This billionaire had top-of-the-line shoes, the same that F1 drivers wear, and they didn't help him one iota. It would be as if a guy showed up at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am with his own custom carbon fiber golf club, teed up, swung, and immediately hooked it into the Pacific Ocean. Another just-thought-you-should-know dickhead thought the billionaire philanthropist cancer survivor should just know that the C-list podcaster was talking shit about him and his expensive shoes. That day, Carter sent me a tweet, and I was thinking, fuck. There's no way he heard this clip, so he probably thinks I was being a real asshole instead of just busting chops. He tweeted me, "I was going to respond to @AdamCarolla remarks on the radio today, but I'm just glad I left a lasting impression. #RealStoryLater. I thought about how I could shoot back with a, "Hey, billionaire, why don't you thicken up your skin?" Or, "Fuck you, I have a pirate ship, I can say whatever I want." Or, "You're too uptight. Maybe you need to get laid." Instead, I replied, @CarterLay, "Sorry for that. I didn't mean to sound so douche." You can tell that was my genuine tweet due to my genuine typos and didn't, fuck apostrophes, and douchey. The real douche is the autocorrect, which changes it to douche when you type that. Well, he simply tweeted back, @AdamCarolla, "Ha ha ha, you're the best. Loved meeting you." It didn't need to be a war. The reason this story is different than the Terry Schiavo one is that a few months after that back and forth, I found out that he died at the young age of 44. I was relieved I hadn't been a dick, that our last exchange hadn't been negative. Tweets are short. You know what else is? Life. Don't waste time entrenching yourself when you've said something impulsive and insultive. I know that's not a word, but it flowed. People often get hyperbolic and say that certain tweets, typically those of Donald Trump and other right-leaning folk, are inciting violence, and those doing the tweeting should be banned from the platform. This is bullshit. The same people that now claim Trump is inciting violence with tweets or formerly the ones who argued against the idea that music and video games incite violence. If Marilyn Manson in NWA lyrics or Grand Theft Auto in Red Dead Redemption aren't causing mass shootings, then neither is Trump's tweets. You have to be logically consistent, not logically convenient. In general, my Twitter rule is this. If you wouldn't say it in an elevator, you shouldn't tweet it. It should take the same effort to talk shit online as it used to take before social media existed. Before you send out that ill-informed tweet calling me a bigot because I had Dinesh D'Souza on my show, you should have to walk to your nearest post office, drop 55 cents, the current price of a stamp as I write this, into the trash can and walk back before you hit send. You should have to go through the same process as sending someone a letter. By the time you walk back from the post office, you'll probably have cooled off. I had a bit that I never got to in the Man Show about a phone breathalyzer for drunk dialers. We need to put something in place for all the assholes with no impulse control who are eager to hit the tweet button. You're not offended, and fuck you if you are. Sadly, people don't use social media for its true intended purpose. Retweeting funny shit that I say on my podcast, which is basically all I use it for. Twitter used to be a place to crack 140-character jokes, let people know about your yard sale, and share a video of your cat falling into the pool. Somewhere along the way, and definitely after Trump got into the race in 2016, it became an outrage factory trying to keep up with the holiday rush. It's not that there's more stuff to be outraged about. It's that people are getting outraged for other people. When did we become empowered to defend people we've never met and have no connection with, especially around race? Any perceived racial slight, even as a joke, is treated like Pearl Harbor. There has never been a better time to actually be a racist because you get lumped in with me and other comedians. Let me give you a couple of personal anecdotes related to white people overcompensating and being outraged on behalf of black people who couldn't give a fuck about me and my jokes. I was at the Monterey Historics, a weekend event full of vintage cars featuring the Concours d'Elegance, a viewing overlooking the Pacific Ocean with cars on display that are worth more than the GDP of several African nations combined. The guys there are dripping in wealth. They wear $4,000 blazers with t-shirts underneath, ascots, and loafers that cost more than the bed or couch you're reading this on. These are the kind of guys who count their money in bundles. Me and my crew were at a table with another rich honky. He was going on about his 1950s Maserati Zagato that they only made 11 of, blah, 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 while well-dressed waiters and waitresses topped off our champagne. I chimed in after he talked about how it was made in Turin and how it felt to drive on the Amalfi Coast. I said, you know, this is what black people think white people do all day. There was an educated middle-aged white woman who was with him who took great umbrage at my joke. This wasn't the ditzy arm candy of some rich dude. Before the joke even landed, she said, whoa, 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 don't go there. I replied, no, I'm making a joke about us. She continued to protest. All right, Mr. Comedian. She heard the word black and assumed it was offensive. She was so racially sensitive and suffering from secondhand outrage, she had to protest. Then recently, I was at the Ice House, a comedy club in Pasadena, doing a little vignette involving race. I said I did my family history on Ancestry.com, and it's a tricky thing nowadays. They're finding out stuff about people's past and their families, even if it's a distant relative. They're holding it against you. It could hurt your career. I didn't know who my great-great-grandpappy was and what he might have done, so I was a little nervous. I got the results back yesterday, and it's worse than I could have ever imagined. It said, current slave owner. A black chick in the back of the room laughed and said out loud, no, you didn't. She got it. The joke was about my being a racist. As I went to the next bit, a woman, not of color, your standard issue 27-year-old LA white chick, chimed in. I said, look, I'm trying to heal the racial divide. Black folks know how to play the game of dominoes. White people set dominoes up on their edge, knock them over, and laugh maniacally. Look, it's my initials. We don't know how to play dominoes. if the black community could reach out to their white brothers and teach us how to actually play the game of dominoes, I think there could be a lot of healing. It's a two-way street. I would do the same. If I saw a group of black guys with a chessboard and they were just knocking the pieces over, laughing like lunatics, I'd intervene. This white chick with her arms folded tisked me. Oh, no. So I started arguing with her. Okay, so everyone knows how to play the game of dominoes evenly? Nothing? No? Okay. White people know how to play the game of dominoes more than black people? She grunted disapprovingly. Okay, some white people know how to play dominoes and some black people know how to play dominoes? She was okay with that. Until I altered the joke so there was no difference between the two groups, until there was nothing to contrast, she expressed her discontent, which is exactly how not to do comedy. My point is this. Did those marginalized people ask for your protection? No. Then why are you treating them like children who can't fend for themselves? If you truly care about marginalized people, you'll afford them the dignity to defend themselves against the outrageous, hurtful comments of guys doing late-night sets at small comedy clubs in Pasadena. If you are in that group, you can be offended. You shouldn't be, but you can be. But if you're not a member of that group being mocked, you can't be an offense agent taking 15% of the outrage. Cultural appropriation is the sincerest form of flattery. Fake outrage gets particularly nutty when we get into the area of cultural appropriation. We're not talking about Al Jolson blackface. We're talking about white women opening a burrito stand and guys getting dressed up as mariachis at parties. Both of these are true stories. Two women in Portland had their burrito business shut down because of cultural appropriation protests after they bragged about going to Mexico and peeking into the kitchen windows to learn how to make authentic tortillas, and the president of the University of Louisville was forced to apologize for wearing a poncho, sombrero, and bushy mustache and holding maracas for a Mexican-themed Halloween costume. It's such bullshit. Anyone who actually wears a sombrero couldn't possibly be offended by this. The purpose of a sombrero and its super wide rim is to keep the sun off you while you toil in the Mexican deserts. If you need that hat and thus have the right to be offended by someone wearing it ironically, then you have too much other shit going on to be offended. You're not worried about a frat boy wearing your native headwear on Cinco de Mayo. You're worried about well water. It's not just hysteria on behalf of Hispanics. There were fake outrage and online protests about Disney's Moana Halloween costumes. Disney has attempted to do the right thing by diversifying and having princesses of color. Go back and look at how the Indians were portrayed in Peter Pan. They were savages. Or dig deep and take a look at Song of the South, which is not surprisingly hard to find on store shelves. Disney and all of Hollywood could tell which way the wind was blowing at the turn of the century, so they started checking all the racial boxes. Mulan, Asian, check. Pocahontas, Native American, check. Jasmine, Middle Eastern, check. Tiana, black, check. Then came Moana. During the run-up to Halloween, Disney tried to make a couple of bucks merchandising their latest non-white, Snow White, and some Caucasian douche had to get his or her panties in a bunch about it. Do you know who suffered? The little Hawaiian, Samoan, and Polynesian girls who finally had a princess who looked like them. It's a fucking Halloween costume. No harm is going to be done, nor is any good. This does not affect anyone's life in any way. I'd like to say to whoever rang the alarm bells and gets to feel like a hero for rescuing the damsel who wasn't in distress, next time, give the story a real fairy tale ending. Put a trash bag over your head, give yourself a duct tape dickie, and let us all live happily ever after. I've long complained about Olympic fencing and have a fix that involves some cultural garb, but first a jag on the sport itself. I realized during the 2012 Olympics, when all we could talk about was swimming and Michael Phelps, that fencing was done. It's sword fighting. It should have been the most exciting event, but all we were talking about was swimming. One problem is that it's over before it begins. The fencers stand 8 feet apart, someone hits an air horn, and by the time you blink, they're taking their masks off. You don't even know who won or why. No one ever gets cut, then tastes their own blood and announces, "Now I shall avenge the death of my father." I can fix this. First, you know there's a compulsory part of skating when the skaters have to pull off certain moves? We should do the same with fencing. To start, the fencers would have to slice all the candles off a candelabra, followed by the part in which they flip their opponent's sword to him with their foot after he drops it. Then they would close by putting a Z in the opponent's shirt without cutting him and slashing a rope to drop a chandelier that traps 8 henchmen. Here's my second solution, which I'm genuinely in love with. This is not a joke. We should make the Olympian fencers wear the garb and use the weapons associated with their nation's history. How high would the ratings be if instead of 2 guys in beekeeper's costumes, it was a contender from Japan in a samurai kimono with a katana going up against a Norwegian athlete wearing a Viking helmet and a fur vest and wielding a battle axe? A French Olympian would be dressed as the 4th musketeer with a thin pointed blade, while the Saudi competitor would be holding a giant scimitar and wearing the outfit of the guy who got shot by Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark. I know this would work. It would have to, because right now Olympic fencing is less interesting than watching Mexican day laborers putting up actual fencing. It used to be the church folk who cared about this stuff. The uptight religious right folks who started petitions to have satanic costumes removed, the Tipper Gores of the world. Now it's the exact opposite. It's the people who are supposed to be the let your freak flag fly crowd who are suppressing everything. They need to take their own advice and moveon.org. It gets particularly stupid when it comes to mascots, team names, and logos. The Washington Redskin controversy finally died down after a Washington Post survey showed that 9 out of 10 Native Americans were not offended. 10 out of 10 douchebags on Twitter and the comments section of HuffPost were offended for them, so they didn't need to be offended. I don't think Redskins are big fans of the pigskin. Native Americans aren't huge football watchers. That didn't stop Cal State Long Beach from getting rid of their Prospector Pete mascot, which became a target of the Golden State Social Justice Warriors because the gold rush led to killing of indigenous people. And in 2015, Governor Jerry Brown signed a law banning public schools in the state from adopting the Redskins moniker for their teams. At the time it was passed, there were only 4 schools using the name, and they were given 2 years to get rid of it. Good job, Jerry. Way to work small to big. Can we please focus on traffic now? Let's worry less about the Redskins and more about the red lights. The real problem with the focus on these nonsense issues is satiation. It just stops you from actually doing anything that will have a genuine effect. As if stopping a school from using a mascot is actually going to accomplish anything for the community you do-gooders are trying to protect. It's like feeding hungry children a boot full of sawdust. They'd announce they're full, and you'd announce your work is done. As if we could just get rid of Uncle Ben and Aunt Jemima, and the black community would have their ship turned around in no time. Think about the actual problems that plague the Native American community. Imagine explaining to their faces that you've been working really hard on the mascot problem. Hey, tutors who are heading to the reservation, turn around. Problem solved. Cancel the orders for the insulin and the substance abuse counselors. Prospector Pete is gone. The only upshot to this stupidity is that it led to one of my favorite bits in a pilot I did for Fox in 2012. My character, Mr. Burcham, was the woodshop teacher at George Washington Junior High School, But the PC crowd did their thing with the school's name, sign, and mascot. It's on YouTube. Google it. The Cult of Correction. The Word Warden's efforts are not about a love of black and brown people. They're about a love of correcting, especially correcting old white guys. Let's do a little quiz. See if you can pick the correct pronunciation for the following words. Carnegie, Carnegie. Can, con. Iraq, Iraq. Qatar, Qatar. The correct answer is, it doesn't fucking matter how you pronounce them. The HuffPo crowd is going to correct you. As soon as you figure out how to say something the way they want, they'll change it so they can have dominion over you. That's what they do. They change accents and syllables, even pronouns, just to give themselves the power to correct you. I find the whole pronunciation problem very divisive. Or do I mean divisive? We're constantly changing the terms. With all the PC stuff on planes, such as removing the words cockpit and stewardess, it's only a matter of time before we get rid of class. How dare we use terms that imply one group is better than the other, even though that other group paid more money and gets perks for it. I heard recently that Eskimo is no longer an appropriate term. Why? Was Eskimo offensive in some way? Can we still call an Eskimo pie? Just because Whitey labeled you with it 80 years ago doesn't make it derogatory. For a very woke group, I'm surprised they're still using the term boycott. Shouldn't it be siscott by now? I could do an entire chapter on the preferred pronoun bullshit and gender versus sex stuff. Those definitions change more often and with more drama than the drag queens employing those monikers. The correct terms around gender and sex are as stable in today's society as a fucking lava lamp. The city of Berkeley, California became a parody of itself last year when it banned all gender-specific words in city ordinances and documents. The word manhole was replaced with maintenance hole. Manpower was out and human effort was in. An even pregnant woman was ousted for pregnant employee. Fraternity and sorority were both replaced with collegiate Greek system resident. And craftsman was replaced by artisan. Congratulations. You replaced the word manhole, but you're still an asshole. The San Francisco area is the tip of the spear, a term I'm sure someone will find offensive when it comes to this change of language to feel good bullshit. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors recently changed the language they use in meetings and documents so that the convicted felons are now referred to as justice-involved persons. Parolees are now returning residents. And an addict is now referred to as a person with a history of substance abuse. So, on your next trip to San Fran, you can look forward to a person with a history of substance abuse who is a returning resident after being justice involved, relieving you of your wallet at the ATM while a helping friendly patrol person, formerly known as a police officer, is busy with the used-to-be homeless, now non-housed person who was a babbling schizophrenic but now is known as a non-reality-bound citizen. Just to be balanced, there is a right-leaning version of this too. Gun guys. Unlike masturbators, they're not quiet about their hobby. They want everyone to know they love guns, and that includes correcting you on your firearm faux pas. To all my NRA member fans reading this, I don't know, nor do I give a fuck, about the difference between a clip and a magazine. This whole language correction thing is retarded. Yes, I used the word fucking intentionally. As a car guy, I'm offended by the attack on the word retarded. In a car, you either advance or retard the engine timing. It simply means to slow something down. Being mentally retarded means your mental growth was slowed down. As if calling someone developmentally delayed makes a fucking difference in the misery that condition causes to the person and their family. I got some pushback from a previous publisher about using the term, but I did not let her retard me in my use of the word retard. That would make me retarded. Out of curiosity, I did a word search and found that the retard count from my previous books is 52. So with this paragraph, I just got it up to an even 60. Social media, a virtual soapbox for virtue signaling. In America, we think we can make problems vanish with slogans. Drug problems? Just say no. Car fatalities? Click it or ticket. Dropouts? No child left behind. Done. That's the bullshit that politicians employ to make it seem like they care. Now it's become a pastime of the civilian as well, in the form of hashtags. Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram are all littered with people standing on digital dioceses and proclaiming themselves to be heroes. It comes out most when tragedy occurs. There used to be three choices of what to do after a natural disaster, mass shooting, or terrorist incident. Number one, cut a check to a charity. Number two, go there like Sean Penn with a shotgun and a paddle. Or number three, and my favorite, shut the fuck up. Now we've added a fourth. Post on social media. Feel proud and proclaim yourself a hero, but accomplish nothing. The algorithm in the head of someone who chooses number four is basically this. I don't want to go to Haiti and get tetanus. I don't want to cut a check because I like my money. What if I just hit Twitter and tear a comedian a new asshole over a joke? The easiest way to do number four is to jump on some trending hashtag, spit out a cliche that shows you're on the right side of the issue, and then get back to binge-watching Netflix. Here are just a couple of the stupidest examples from the past few years. Hashtag, Oscars so white. I love the idea of all the actors and directors who got on board with that hashtag complaining about the lack of diversity in nominees when they're the Academy. It's not like the crew voting on the Oscars are the people in the MAGA caps at a Florida Trump rally. If you don't think the Oscars are diverse enough, vote for more diversity. Hashtag, we are Cecil. The people who live in Africa where Cecil the Lion was shot don't give a fuck. But the Yentas in Orange County, California, were aghast. This is the definition of a liberal, when the feelings overtake the facts. The human body count from issues people don't want to discuss, like black gang violence in Chicago or murders committed by illegal immigrants in Texas, Arizona, and California, far outweigh the animal death toll from trophy hunting. But it was an easy issue to take a stance on and feel good about. I would love to build a time machine for the express purpose of going back to 2014. About 11 months before the dentist who killed Cecil went on safari and say to him, guess what's going to be the biggest Halloween costume this coming year? I don't know. Wonder Woman? Nope. You. What? I'm a dentist from Roanoke, Virginia. Yes, and you're going to be the biggest Halloween costume of 2015. As he asked why, I would just cackle and fire up the time machine to leave his blown mind to sort it out. Hashtag, boycott Peter Rabbit. This one forced Sony Pictures to issue an apology for a scene in Peter Rabbit in which the bunnies throw blackberries at the farmer after finding out he's allergic to them. He collapses before injecting himself with an EpiPen. This spawned the aforementioned hashtag and an online petition I have to assume was sponsored by a group called Future Pussies of America. Who are these people who have the energy to write earnestly that this promotes allergy bullying? Even worse, Sony responded, "Food allergies are a serious issue. Our film should not have made light of Peter Rabbit's arch nemesis, Mr. McGregor, being allergic to blackberries, even in a cartoonish slapstick way. We sincerely regret not being more aware and sensitive to this issue, and we truly apologize." Again, a forced apology is only about shutting you up or getting a blowjob sometime in the future. It means nothing. Of course, the grandmother of them all is hashtag me too, but that warrants its own chapter. I get why this happens. Dr. Drew was recently talking about getting involved in some hashtag discussion and received a lot of positive feedback. He liked it. As any addiction medicine specialist should, he knew he was feeling high. Human beings are wired to alleviate pain. Pain is a signal that something needs to change, like walking on a broken ankle. It hurts because you're making it worse. Well, there's a human need to be with other humans, to feel safe in our tribe. Our tribe is now on Twitter. So, we watch what we say to avoid the pain of taking shit on Twitter, and we join in on the groupthink, aka hashtags and trending topics, to feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves. This problem is only going to get worse. It's a feedback loop. The less employable you are, the more time you have to be on the internet complaining about stuff and making yourself look like a hero. A real hero would be out there doing something, or at least working and paying taxes. You assholes with your hemp Priuses parked outside the Starbucks where you're working on your shitty screenplays have nothing but time. How about this one that I hope trends after this book comes out? Hashtag get the fuck to work. The cancer of cancel culture. The most dangerous form of social media misuse is so-called cancellation. When we drudge up high school photos, ancient interviews, or old social media posts of people years later, sometimes after they're dead, and cancel those people. I hate that, well, what about bullshit? We shouldn't be constantly punching at the rearview mirror of life. Let's focus on what is happening now that we can do better with, and what we can prepare for or prevent in the future. Responding to someone bringing up the issue of Muslim extremism with, well, what about the Crusades, accomplishes nothing other than making me stop listening to you. Judging history by the standards of today is the most annoying habit of the left. Won't future generations in 200 years look back at us and say, Adam Carolla wasn't genderqueer? Well, I shan't be watching his show anymore. He was a monster. There's a lot of trashing of the founding fathers for being slave owners. The horrors of slavery are obvious to us now, but 200 years ago, that horror was a common practice. At the time, you would have been an idiot not to own slaves. The only reason more people didn't is because they couldn't afford them. Slaves weren't seen as people. They were property. And who wouldn't want more property? How do you think our grandkids' grandkids will look at us paying Mexicans $11 an hour to haul trash, put up concrete block walls, and dig ditches? In 40 years, when we have robots doing all the manual labor, how will history judge us for paying real people just above free? Slavery was free. What we're paying Mexicans is just slightly more than that. Our current agreement with the most destitute people on the planet is, you will toil in the hot sun all day, and at the end of the day, I will pay you just enough to buy a Filet-O-Fish. You think history's going to be kind to this? Yet there are plenty of progressives, like my mom and grandmother, who will happily pay gardeners and laborers as little as they can afford to without getting arrested. While they're watching Roots and preaching about the evils of slavery, they were basically practicing slavery light. Last year, someone dug up and posted on Twitter a 1971 Playboy interview with John Wayne. Are you sitting down? He said some racist, homophobic shit. Yes, in 1971, the Duke used the word faggot and said we should have taken the land from the Indians. Can you believe it? The star of Stagecoach and Fort Apache? My world is upside down. It's nuts that we're now living in a time when dead celebrities still need a PR team. Some post-mortem publicist is going to need to get the estate of John Wayne to okay a CGI avatar with Rich Little doing the voice to go on The View and say, howdy, Pilgrim. I like pilgrims of all races and sexual and gender orientations. And I sincerely apologize for my hurtful words in 1971. Why are we burning calories being offended by stuff from the past? I feel like I can watch a Roman Polanski movie, listen to a little Michael Jackson, and eat at a Mario Batali restaurant despite their actions. All I'm asking is that we have some context. Henry Ford was a well-documented anti-Semite. He distributed anti-Jewish conspiracy literature to all of his employees. He manufactured the planes test-piloted by the second biggest anti-Semite, Charles Lindbergh. But when the rubber hit the road, literally in World War II, we would not have defeated Hitler had Ford not built Willow Run and turned his other factories into the arsenal of democracy. That's what's important, actions, not thoughts or feelings. Of course, this digital dredging bullshit also led to Kevin Hart's stepping down to host the Academy Awards. When he didn't pass the left's purity test because of some 10-year-old homophobic jokes, we ended up with a host-free, all-woke, no-joke Oscars. Then there was a friend of my show, James Gunn. He was a guest before he ever hit it big with the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise, and is someone I'll always respect and wish well. Which is why I was extra pissed when some conservative blogger took umbrage to his anti-Trump stance and busted out a shovel and started digging for indignation and created an unnecessary issue that got him booted from directing the third film in the series. The twisted sensibility that led to a great movie franchise is also the twisted sensibility that wrote jokes about rape and pedophilia. He's edgy. He's like the straight John Waters, except with talent. I want him going to the line and occasionally past it. That's what being an artist is. Fortunately, this digital indignation incident had a happy ending when his cast and his fans stood up for him and Disney rehired him. He was briefly canceled, but got clemency at the last minute. The problem is, we have no standard for what constitutes a hanging offense. There are plenty of people who have done a lot worse than James Gunn or Roseanne Barr who didn't get canceled. We're all treated to Shaq doing commercials for Papa John's Pizza because their company founder, John Schnatter, accurately talked about Colonel Sanders using the N-word while on a conference call and was then dimed out by his own crisis manager. He lost a multi-million-dollar company he built himself in 1984 out of a broom closet with $1,600 he got from selling his Camaro. Yet Papa John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas was having a sexual relationship with his own daughter, and California Dreaming is still in heavy rotation on every oldie station. Again, this is Chick Think. 50 years ago, men weren't gossips who would tell you shitty things people said because they just thought you should know. That was the dominion of housewives talking over coffee while their husbands were at work. Now all the young dudes carry the news that no one needs to know on an iPhone in their skinny jeans pocket. The tattletale pussy who goes through James Gunn's Twitter timeline to let you know he made some gay jokes a decade ago is no better than the sitcom nosy neighbor peeping over the fence to get some gossip to spread around the neighborhood. Fuck you, Mrs. Kravitz. Google it. This one is addressed to the 51-year-olds talking about getting off of Twitter because it's bumming them out. I hear many people talking about social media vacations, especially in the Trump era. I hear adult males talk about being bummed out all day and crying in front of their children because of something they saw posted online. I know I just spent a whole chapter complaining about social media, but I never said we should get rid of it or that I couldn't handle it. Like every problem in society, I want to look at it, figure out how we can make it better, and make a couple of bucks complaining about it on my podcast or in a book. My wiring is good when it comes to this stuff. I use Twitter like I use all tools, for the right job and only when necessary. No one can make me feel a certain way about myself. I give a tweet as much credence as something muttered by a homeless guy. I'm going to be in charge of how I feel about myself. People will tweet me horrible shit like, I feel sorry for your wife and daughter. Okay, fuckface. I'll pass that along to them as soon as they get out of the fucking jacuzzi. The one that's in the master suite, not the one attached to the pool. So don't shed any tears for them. Say just saw Adam doing stand-up, and I'll tune in. But if you jump right to, Adam is the unfunniest fuck on the planet, and here's why, I'm not going to listen to the remainder of the sentence. If your intention is to get me or my mind to change, then you have failed miserably. When you start calling everyone Hitler, the targets of your ire tune out. It's too extreme. We need to be able to understand intention and not be so reactive. We aren't going to change the way we communicate, but we can change the way we feel. The social media horse has left the barn. If you can't handle it, you're fucked. This is mental weakness. How precarious is your self-esteem that one tweet can knock it off its shelf? If people being mean to each other or saying things you disagree with can get you that depressed, you don't need to get off Twitter. You need to get on Zoloft. All that said, Twitter and other social media posts shall be the records of the time period when our civilization collapsed, which at the rate we're going should be about noonish on Saturday. When the archaeologists or aliens come here later to study our ruins, I just wish I could be around to see them amazed at the stupid shit we cared about and how much time we spent tweeting at windmills. Chapter 6. Academia Nuts. I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I was put on academic probation at Valley College, a public community college in L.A. My Ivy League was my first construction job, pulling ivy off the side of a house in Silver Lake. It was pretty much spot welded to the stucco. I'd yank it, and it would come off with a pop, a plume of 50 years worth of rat shit and soot from settled freeway smog would shake off and pour into my lungs. I'd lug the ivy to the dumpster and do it again until I wanted to kill myself. It was a Sisyphean task. I had to look that one up. I thought Sisyphus was an insult combining sissy and puss. So while I'm not fully qualified to talk about free speech on campuses, I'm going to speak freely about it anyway. We had a saying when I was a lad that kids today need to start using again. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never hurt me. On college campuses nowadays, kids have decided that names can hurt. Much like the correction cultists I talked about earlier, campus language cops have changed the definition of the word dangerous. They say the points Ben Shapiro makes about abortion, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, for example, are not things they disagree with, but rather are dangerous. I would posit that there are no dangerous words. I'm pretty sure George Carlin and his 7 dirty words would agree with me. It goes back to the mentality of victimhood permeating our culture. These college kids are looking for a victimizer to fit their narrative in which they are victims. In comes big bad Ben Shapiro with his hurtful and dangerous rhetoric. Rhetoric can't harm. It's right there in the term. Ever hear of a rhetorical question? It's defined as a question asked for the sake of persuasive effect rather than as a genuine request for information. It's about making a point, not about inciting violence. Even if people were engaging in racist, bigoted, or homophobic hate speech, that should be the easiest to shoot down, right? Let's say Ben Shapiro's message actually is black people are inferior. That's an easy argument to defeat. It's not too difficult to win an intellectual argument with a Klansman. Klansmen come armed with burning crosses, but not a lot of facts. And it's hard to hear them through the hoods. The problem is that Ben's points are nuanced and backed up with statistics. If he was just spouting out racist tropes, he'd fare as well in his arguments as Archie Bunker did against Meathead. But rather than enter a debate they know they'd lose, people on campuses say Ben Shapiro is spouting out dangerous hate speech, get virtue points for standing up to it, call themselves brave, and avoid getting humiliated by Ben. You know who is brave? Ben fucking Shapiro. He doesn't say what he says from the safety of a podcast studio. He wades into angry mobs on college campuses or Black Lives Matter rallies stands his ground, and says his piece. This is a diminutive Jew. He's the one with the target on his yarmulke. For a group that crows incessantly about diversity, how about the diversity of ideas? I'm much more interested in having a variety of brains on campuses than a variety of skin colors. There's hell to pay on campuses now if the faculty, student body, and guest speakers don't look like one of those fake multiracial bands or groups at rooftop parties you see in beer and credit card ads. When it comes to multiculturalism, it seems to not include my culture, which is sane people. There are campus officials with genuinely straight faces saying things like, "I'm all for free speech. I defend everyone's right to free speech. I just need to hear what it is first so I can vet it to see if it's allowable or not." They greenlight only the stuff they agree with. This is Harvard and Yale, not the Wally Thorpe School of Trucking. Shouldn't you have more intellectual honesty if you're a top intellectual institution? People are getting sick of this crap. A study shows that alumni are not donating as much to their respective alma maters because they see this campus cowardice and think about when their protests were for shit that actually mattered, like Vietnam, feminism, and civil rights. This is the generation that saw their friends gunned down by the National Guard at Kent State. They couldn't give a fuck about you pussies crying into your stuffed animals because Milo Yiannopoulos is defending Donald Trump. So they're putting their checkbooks away. In 2016 at DePaul University, Milo was attacked on stage by a group of Black Lives Matter protesters. Security personnel did nothing because they were scared. They didn't want the hassle and negative attention of taking black protesters off the stage. If someone were to rush the stage while Jon Stewart was doing a set, security would be on it. But because it was Milo contradicting the idea of systemic racism, they turned a blind eye. I don't get the idea of using aggression and violence against conservative speakers on campus. I think that behavior kind of proves their point. I would understand violence breaking out over a difference of opinion at a bar or a naval vessel, but on a college campus, you're supposed to be intellectual, able to hear differing opinions and debate them. The dumbos I grew up with are the ones who swing broken beer bottles at people and inanimate objects they don't like. "That mailbox is giving me the stink eye." You should be wielding your ideas, not pepper spray. Why get so agitated? Just move on. Here are a few events that took place at the University of California, Berkeley in 2018. I had my staff pull for the podcast. These are events I would never go to. Solidarity for Nicaragua, Caravan for Peace. Mother, Daughter, Sister, film screening and panel on sexual violence in Myanmar. Teaching about dialect, identity variation and power. Identifying and addressing workplace bullying. Actually, regarding that last one, I'd like to not only attend, but preside. I'd flick the lights on and off once and say, "You're all worthless and weak. Now get the fuck out of here, pussies." Again, I'd never go to any of these events, but I would never try to interrupt or protest them either. If you don't agree with the topic, how about you just don't fucking go? Musical acts play campuses all the time. Let's take Duran Duran, for example. I find their music to be a macroaggression toward my ears. I am offended as a person with good taste in music. But if I were a student and I found out that Duran Duran was playing my campus, I just wouldn't go. I wouldn't feel the need to protest or call in a bomb threat. I would simply go off campus, find a bar with some Elvis Costello in the jukebox, and get shit-faced. Administrators coddle protesters and encourage this nonsense. In 2016, one college went so far as to remove an incredibly incendiary, violence-inciting symbol of hate. We sane people know it as the American flag. It was at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. Go fighting pussies. It seems that after Trump's election, some students were so triggered that they lowered the flag to half staff in protest. The campus authorities, and I use that word loosely, kept it at half staff until the next night when it was burned. Rather than deal with the fuckwads who committed arson, they took the flag down entirely. The college president said the students who burned it saw the flag as a powerful symbol of fear they felt all their lives because they grew up in marginalized communities never feeling safe. Back to the victimization identity. If you traveled back in time to 1963, interrupted a Don and Betty Draper-esque couple eating a homemade casserole, enjoying a martini and watching Ed Sullivan, and told them, in the future, we'll have something called an iPhone. It will be a television, a telephone, a map, a calculator, a record player, a camera, and a butler, all in one device the size of the pack of Lucky Strikes you're currently smoking at the dinner table.